The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie, Chapter 12. Extract from the Diary of Sir Eustace Pedler. There's something to be said for life on board ship. It's peaceful. My gray hairs fortunately exempt me from the indignities of bobbing for apples, running up and down the deck with potatoes and eggs, and the more painful sports of Brother Bill and Bolster Bar. What amusement people can find in these painful proceedings has always been a mystery to me, but there are many fools in the world. One praises God for their existence and keeps out of their way. Fortunately, I'm an excellent sailor. Paget, poor fellow, is not. He began turning green as soon as we were out on the Solent. I presume my other so-called secretary is also seasick. At any rate, he's not yet made his appearance. But perhaps it's not seasickness, but high diplomacy. The great thing is that I have not been worried by him. On the whole, the people on board are a mangy lot. Only two decent bridge players and one decent-looking woman, Mrs. Clarence Blair. I've met her in town, of course. She's one of the only women I know who can lay claim to a sense of humor. I enjoy talking to her, and should enjoy it more if it were not for a long-legged, taciturn ass who has attached himself to her, like a limpet. I cannot think that this Colonel Race really amuses her. He's good-looking in his way, but dull as ditchwater. One of these strong, silent men that lady novelists and young girls always rave over. Guy Paget struggled up on deck after we left Madeira and began babbling in a hollow voice about work. What the devil does anyone want to work for on board ship? It's true that I promised my publishers my reminiscences early in the summer, but what of it? Who really reads reminiscences? Old ladies in the suburbs. And what do my reminiscences amount to? I've knocked against a certain number of so-called famous people in my lifetime. With the assistance of Paget, I invent insipid anecdotes about them. And the truth of the matter is, Paget is too honest for the job. He won't let me invent anecdotes about the people I might have met but haven't. I tried kindness with him. "You look a perfect wreck still, my dear chap," I said easily. "What you need is a deck chair in the sun." "No, not another word. The work must wait." The next thing I knew, he was worrying about an extra cabin. "There's no room to work in your cabin, Sir Eustace. It's full of trunks." From his tone, you might have thought that trunks were black beetles, something that had no business to be there. I explained to him that, though he might not be aware of the fact, it was usual to take a change of clothing with one when traveling. He gave the wan smile with which he always greets my attempts at humor, and then reverted to the business at hand. "And we could hardly work in my little hole." I know Paget's little holes. He usually has the best cabin on the ship. "I'm sorry the captain didn't turn out for you this time," I said sarcastically. "Perhaps you'd like to dump some of your extra luggage in my cabin." Sarcasm is dangerous with a man like Paget. He brightened up at once. "Well, if I could get rid of the typewriter and the stationery trunk." The stationery trunk weighs several solid tons. It causes endless unpleasantness with the porters, and it's the aim of Paget's life to foist it on me. It's a perpetual struggle between us. He seems to regard it as my special personal property. I, on the other hand, regard the charge of it as the only thing where a secretary is really useful. "We'll get an extra cabin," I said hastily. The thing seems simple enough, but Paget is a person who loves to make mysteries. He came to me the next day with a face like a Renaissance conspirator. "You know you told me to get cabin 17 for an office?" "Well, what of it? Has the stationary trunk jammed in the doorway?" "The doorways are the same size in all the cabins," replied Paget seriously. "But I tell you, Sir Eustace, there's something very queer about that cabin." Memories of reading The Upper Berth floated through my mind. "If you mean that it's haunted," I said, "we're not going to sleep there. So I don't see that it matters. Ghosts don't affect typewriters." Paget said that it wasn't a ghost, and that, after all, he hadn't got Cabin 17. He told me a long, garbled story. Apparently he and a Mr. Chichester and a girl called Bedingfeld had almost come to blows over the cabin. Needless to say, the girl had won, and Paget was apparently feeling sore over the matter. Both 13 and 28 are better cabins, he reiterated, but they wouldn't look at them. Well, I said, stifling a yawn, for that matter, no more would you, my dear Paget. He gave me a reproachful look. You told me to get Cabin 17. There's a touch of the boy upon the burning deck about Paget. My dear fellow, I said testily, I mentioned number 17 because I happened to observe that it was vacant, but I didn't mean you to make a stand to the death about it. 13 or 28 would have done us equally well. He looked hurt. There's something more, though, he insisted. Miss Bedingfeld got the cabin, but this morning I saw Chichester coming out of it in a furtive sort of way. I looked at him severely. If you're trying to get up a nasty scandal about Chichester, who's a missionary, though a perfectly poisonous person, and that attractive child Ann Bedingfeld, I don't believe a word of it, I said coldly. Ann Bedingfeld is an extremely nice girl, with particularly good legs. I should say she had far and away the best legs on board. Paget didn't like my reference to Ann Bedingfeld's legs. He's the sort of man who never notices legs himself, or if he does, would die sooner than say so. Also, he thinks my appreciation of such things frivolous. But I like annoying Paget, so I continued maliciously. As you've made her acquaintance, you might ask her to dine at our table tomorrow night. It's the fancy dress dance. By the way, you'd better go down to the barber and select a fancy costume for me. Surely you'll not go in fancy dress, said Paget in tones of horror. I could see that it was quite incompatible with his idea of my dignity. He looked shocked and pained. I had really no intention of donning fancy dress, but the complete discomfiture of Paget was too tempting to be forborne. What do you mean? I said. Of course I shall wear fancy dress. So will you. Paget shuddered. So go down to the barber's and see about it, I finished. I don't think he'll have any outsizes, murmured Paget, measuring my figure with his eye. Without meaning it, Paget can occasionally be extremely offensive. And order a table for six in the saloon, I said. We'll have the captain, the girl with the nice legs, Mrs. Blair. You won't get Mrs. Blair without Colonel Race, Paget interposed. He asked her to dine with him, I know. Paget always knows everything. I was justifiably annoyed. Who is Race? I demanded, exasperated. As I said before, Paget always knows everything, or thinks he does. He looked mysterious again. They say he's a Secret Service chap, Sir Eustace. Rather a great gun, too. But of course, I don't know for certain. Isn't that like the government? I exclaimed. Here's a man on board whose business it is to carry about secret documents, and they go giving them to a peaceful outsider who only asks to be let alone. Paget looked even more mysterious. He came a pace nearer and dropped his voice. If you ask me, the whole thing is very queer, Sir Eustace. Look at that illness of mine before we started. My dear fellow, I interrupted brutally, that was a bilious attack. You're always having bilious attacks. Paget winced slightly. It wasn't the usual sort of bilious attack. This time, for God's sake, don't go into the details of your condition, Paget. I don't want to hear them. Very well, Sir Eustace. But my belief is that I was deliberately poisoned. Ah, I said, you've been talking to Rayburn. He didn't deny it. At any rate, Sir Eustace, he thinks so, and he should be in a position to know. By the way, where is the chap? I asked. I've not set eyes on him since we came on board. He gives out that he's ill and stays in his cabin, Sir Eustace. Paget's voice dropped again. But that's camouflage, I'm sure, so that he can watch better. Watch? Over your safety, Sir Eustace, in case an attack should be made upon you. You're such a cheerful fellow, Paget, I said. I trust that your imagination runs away with you. If I were you, I should go to the dance as a death's head or an executioner. It'll suit your mournful style of beauty. That shut him up for the time being. I went on deck. The Bedingfeld girl was deep in conversation with the missionary parson Chichester. Women always flutter around parsons. A man of my figure hates stooping, but I had the courtesy to pick up a bit of paper that was fluttering round the parson's feet. I got no word of thanks for my pains. As a matter of fact, I couldn't help seeing what was written on the sheet of paper. There was just one sentence. Don't try to play a lone hand, or it will be the worse for you. That's a nice thing for a parson to have. Who is this fellow, Chichester, I wonder? He looks mild as milk. But looks are deceptive. I shall ask Paget about him. Paget always knows everything. I sank gracefully into my deck chair by the side of Mrs. Blair, thereby interrupting her tête-à-tête with Race, and remarked that I didn't know what the clergy were coming to nowadays. Then I asked her to dine with me on the night of the fancy dress dance. Somehow or other, Race managed to get included in the invitation. After lunch, the Bedingfeld girl came and sat with us for coffee. I was right about her legs. They are the best on the ship. I certainly shall ask her to dinner as well. I would very much like to know what mischief Paget was up to in Florence. Whenever Italy is mentioned, he goes to pieces. If I didn't know how intensely respectable he is, I should suspect him of some disreputable amour. I wonder now. Even the most respectable men. It would cheer me up enormously if it was so. Paget, with a guilty secret. Splendid! Chapter 13. It has been a curious evening. The only costume that fitted me in the barber's emporium was that of a teddy bear. I don't mind playing bears with some nice young girls on a winter's evening in England, but it's hardly an ideal costume for the equator. However, I created a good deal of merriment and won first prize for brought on board, an absurd term for a costume hired for the evening. Still, as nobody seemed to have the least idea whether they were made or brought, it didn't matter. Mrs. Blair refused to dress up. Apparently, she's at one with Paget on the matter. Colonel Race followed her example. Anne Bedingfeld had concocted a gypsy costume for herself and looked extraordinarily well. Paget said he had a headache and didn't appear. To replace him, I asked a quaint little fellow called Reeves. He's a prominent member of the South African Labour Party. Horrible little man, but I want to keep in with him, as he gives me information that I need. I want to understand this Rand business from both sides. Dancing was a hot affair. I danced twice with Anne Bedingfeld, and she had to pretend she liked it. I danced once with Mrs. Blair, who didn't trouble to pretend, and I victimized various other damsels whose appearance struck me favorably. Then we went down to supper. I had ordered champagne. The steward suggested Clicquot 1911 as being the best they had on the boat, and I fell in with his suggestion. I seemed to have hit on the one thing that would loosen Colonel Race's tongue. Far from being taciturn, the man became actually talkative. For a while, this amused me. Then it occurred to me that Colonel Race, and not myself, was becoming the life and soul of the party. He chaffed me at length about keeping a diary. "It will reveal all your indiscretions one of these days, peddler." "My dear Rice," I said, "I venture to suggest that I am not quite the fool you think me. I may commit indiscretions, but I don't write them down in black and white. After my death, my executors will know my opinion of a great many people, but I doubt if they'll find anything to add or detract from their opinion of me. A diary is useful for recording the idiosyncrasies of other people, but not one's own. There is such a thing as unconscious self-revelation, though. In the eyes of the psychoanalyst, all things are vile, I replied sententiously. You must have had a very interesting life, Colonel Race, said Miss Bedingfeld, gazing at him with wide, starry eyes. That's how they do it, these girls. Othello charmed Desdemona by telling her stories. But, oh, didn't Desdemona charm Othello by the way she listened? Anyway, the girls set Race off all right. He began to tell lion stories. A man who has shot lions in large quantities has an unfair advantage over other men. It seemed to me that it was time I, too, told a lion story, one of a more sprightly character. By the way, I remarked, that reminds me of a rather exciting tale I heard. A friend of mine was out on a shooting trip somewhere in East Africa. One night he came out of his tent for some reason and was startled by a low growl. He turned sharply and saw a lion crouching to spring. He had left his rifle in the tent. Quick as thought, he ducked, and the lion sprang right over his head. Annoyed at having missed him, the animal growled and prepared to spring again. Again he ducked, and again the lion sprang right over him. This happened a third time. But by now he was close to the entrance of the tent, and he darted in and seized his rifle. When he emerged, rifle in hand, the lion had disappeared. That puzzled him greatly. He crept round the back of the tent, where there was a little clearing. There, sure enough, was the lion, busily practicing low jumps. This was received with a roar of applause. I drank some champagne. On another occasion, I remarked, this friend of mine had a second curious experience. He was trekking across country, and being anxious to arrive at his destination before the heat of the day, he ordered his boys to inspan while it was still dark. They had some trouble in doing so, as the mules were very restive, but at last they managed it, and a start was made. The mules raced along like the wind, and when daylight came, they saw why. In the darkness, the boys had inspanned a lion as the near wheeler. This, too, was well received, a ripple of merriment going round the table. But I'm not sure that the greatest tribute did not come from my friend, the labor member, who remained pale and serious. My God, he said anxiously, who unharnessed them? I must go to Rhodesia, said Mrs. Blair. After what you've told us, Colonel Race, I simply must. It's a horrible journey, though, 5 days in the train. You must join me on my private car, I said gallantly. Oh, Sir Eustace, how sweet of you. Do you really mean it? Do I mean it? I exclaimed reproachfully, and drank another glass of champagne. Just about another week, and we shall be in South Africa, sighed Mrs. Blair. Ah, South Africa, I said sentimentally, and began to quote from a recent speech of mine at the Colonial Institute. What has South Africa to show the world? What indeed? Her fruit and her farms, her wool and her wattles, her herds and her hides, her gold and her diamonds. I was hurrying on because I knew that as soon as I paused, Reeves would butt in and inform me that the hides were worthless because the animals hung themselves up on barbed wire or something of that sort, would crab everything else and end up with the hardships of the miners on the rand, and I was not in the mood to be abused as a capitalist. However, the interruption came from another source at the magic word diamonds. Diamonds, said Mrs. Blair ecstatically. Diamonds, breathed Miss Bedingfeld. They both addressed Colonel Race. I suppose you've been to Kimberley. I had been to Kimberley, too, but I didn't manage to say so in time. Race was being inundated with questions. What were mines like? Was it true that the natives were kept shut up in compounds? And so on. Race answered their questions and showed a good knowledge of his subject. He described the methods of housing the natives, the searches instituted, and the various precautions that De Beers took. "Then it's practically impossible to steal any diamonds?" asked Mrs. Blair, with as keen an air of disappointment as though she'd been journeying there for the express purpose. "Nothing's impossible, Mrs. Blair. Thefts do occur, like the case I told you of where the Kaffir hid the stone in his wound." "Yes, but on a large scale. Once, in recent years, just before the war, in fact. You must remember the case, Peddler. You were in South Africa at the time." I nodded. "Tell us," cried Miss Bedingfeld. "Oh, do tell us." Race smiled. "Very well. You shall have the story. I suppose most of you have heard of Sir Lawrence Eardsley, the great South African mining magnate. His mines were gold mines, but he comes into the story through his son. You may remember that just before the war, rumors were afield of a new potential Kimberley hidden somewhere in the rocky floor of the British Guiana jungles. Two young explorers, so it was reported, had returned from that part of South Africa, bringing with them a remarkable collection of rough diamonds, some of them of considerable size. Diamonds of small size had been found before in the neighborhood of the Essequibo and Mazarani rivers, but these two young men, John Eardsley and his friend Lucas, claimed to have discovered beds of great carbon deposits at the common head of the two streams. The diamonds were of every color, pink, blue, yellow, green, black, and the purest white. Eardsley and Lucas came to Kimberley, where they were to submit their gems to inspection. At the same time, a sensational robbery was found to have taken place at De Beers. When sending diamonds to England, they're made up into a packet. This remains in the big safe, of which the two keys are held by two different men, while a third man knows the combination. They're handed to the bank, and the bank send them to England. Each package is worth roughly about £100,000. On this occasion, the bank were struck by something a little unusual about the sealing of the packet. It was opened and found to contain knobs of sugar. Exactly how suspicion came to fasten on John Eardsley, I don't know. It was remembered that he'd been very wild at Cambridge, and that his father had paid his debts more than once. Anyhow, it soon got about that this story of South American diamond fields was all a fantasy. John Eardsley was arrested. In his possession was found a portion of the De Beers diamonds. But the case never came to court. Sir Lawrence Eardsley paid over a sum equal to the missing diamonds, and De Beers didn't prosecute. Exactly how the robbery was committed has never been known. But the knowledge that his son was a thief broke the old man's heart. He had a stroke shortly afterwards. As for John, his fate was in a way merciful. He enlisted, went to the war, fought there bravely, and was killed, thus wiping out the stain on his name. Sir Lawrence himself had a third stroke and died about a month ago. He died intestate, and his vast fortune passed to his next of kin, a man whom he hardly knew. The colonel paused. A babble of ejaculations and questions broke out. Something seemed to attract Miss Bedingfeld's attention, and she turned in her chair. At the little gasp she gave, I too turned. My new secretary, Rayburn, was standing in the doorway. Under his tan, his face had the pallor of one who's seen a ghost. Evidently, Race's story had moved him profoundly. Suddenly conscious of our scrutiny, he turned abruptly and disappeared. Do you know who that is? Asked Van Bedingfeld abruptly. That's my other secretary, I explained. Mr. Rayburn. He's been seedy up to now. She toyed with the bread by her plate. Has he been your secretary long? Not very long, I said cautiously. But caution is useless with a woman. The more you hold back, the more she presses forward. Ann Bedingfeld made no bones about it. How long? She asked bluntly. Well, I engaged him just before I sailed. Old friend of mine recommended him. She said nothing more, but relapsed into a thoughtful silence. I turned to Race with the feeling that it was my turn to display an interest in his story. Who is Sir Lawrence's next of kin, Race? Do you know? I should say so, he replied with a smile. I am.